Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we got on our agenda today?
We have a packed econ data agenda. We'll touch on some housing, consumer data, as well as labor, inflation, and GDP. But on today's episode, we're going to do something a little bit different, and we'll bring in another Altus voice. So we'll include a snippet from a great conversation that we recently had with Dan Kudrick. But just to kick it off and with the normal programming, Cole, do you want to share some of the latest housing data?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a packed few weeks, so we're going to try to go sequentially through some of these releases. So one of the first ones that we got the other week was new home sale data. So this is from the U.S. Census Bureau and HUD. It was released on the 25th. They showed a really large jump month over month in single family home sales, a 20.5%. Brought it up to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 800,000. But the agency noted a pretty big confidence interval on that. So the 90% confidence interval was plus or minus 21.8%. So the true change could be much smaller to even negligible. So I think that's an interesting nugget there. But on an annual basis, that figure was up 15.9%. The median price of a new single family home climbed $413,500. That was up 1.9% annually. And there's been some evidence that builders are leaning on incentives such as simple price cuts or mortgage rate buydowns to sustain some of the demand. But we also got existing home sale data, and these are great to pair together because the existing home sale market is a much larger portion of overall home sales. A National Association of Realtors puts this figure out. This was on the same day, September 25th. They showed that existing home sales were down 0.2% in August to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4 million. So essentially flat on an annual basis, but these are very low relative to history, still just above where we were at the height of the GFC. So there are major affordability challenges. They are definitely weighing on the resale market. Median existing home price rose to $422,600, not fundamentally different from the price of a new single family home. Also up 2% from the year. Inventory continued to dip though, 1.53 million homes, equal to about 4.6 months worth of supply. And that's quite a bit lower than what would be considered a healthy market. So mortgage rates have dipped recently, just above 6.2% on average in August, but still too high to really unlock demand. So new home sales appear to be improving, but there's a really wide margin of error on that figure. So the strength is a bit questionable. Reliable year-over-year gains would otherwise point to some greater stabilization. Still not really seeing a sharp recovery, though. Again, existing home sales, historically low levels, just reinforcing this point we've made many times on the show that home ownership is out of reach for many buyers, can definitely funnel some of that demand into rental housing. And you've seen this from kind of other housing economists or folks that are beginning to get concerned. This has been going on for quite some time. Prolonged affordability challenges and constraints could really slow household formation. That would weigh on the broader kind of consumer-driven market. So also wanted to mention, we got some pricing data that's showing cracks. This was the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It's the S&P Cotality, or for you CRE data nerds, CoreLogic Case-Shiller indices came out on September 30th. So they showed that U.S. home prices in July actually were up 1.7% year on year. And this is instead of the median price of a home, these are known resale transactions of homes. So they split this up into a 20-city, 10-city, and a national composite index. So the 20-city composite rose 1.8%. The 10-city rose 2.3%. And after seasonal adjustment, the national index was actually down on the month. So that was the second consecutive monthly decline. And what's really interesting here and was noted in the release is that price growth is actually running below consumer inflation. So this is really the third straight month of real housing wealth erosion. Where this gets really interesting is at the regional level. Some trends in the Northeast and the Midwest, really strong price growth on a year-on-year basis. In New York, 6.4%, Chicago, 6.2%, and Cleveland, 4.5%. But then declines in the Sun Belt. So Tampa, minus 2.8%, Miami, down 1.3%. And then out west in San Francisco, down 1.9%. Thought this was super interesting. Very clear that price growth is strong in markets where not a lot of housing gets built, particularly single family housing. And I thought San Francisco was kind of a weird outlier here, but I think this could actually point to some negative demand trends there instead of a supply side analysis there. But anyways, a lot of housing data. I think you're still seeing those affordability challenges, but stuff is really beginning to crack if you look at the pricing level. You know, one of the biggest releases that we got last week was the PCE price index, but a lot of people may not know that's part of the broader personal income and outlays report. What'd you find in there?
Yeah, so you're spot on, and we'll dive into both the PCE as well as some of the key takeaways from the broader release, which is the personal income and outlays. So this was released by the Bureau of Economic Analysis on the 26th, and it covered the month of August. And I think some of the kind of data points that the market focuses most attention on is the PCE price indices that is provided in that release. And the reason for that is not only is it a great gauge of inflation, there are many inflation measures out there, but this is the one that the Fed really hones in on. And this is the primary inflation metric. So the PCE price index rose 0.3% in August over July and 2.7% year on year, while core inflation held at 2.9% annual rate of change. In terms of the major types of expenditures, breaking down into goods and services, the services PCE advanced at a rate of 3.6% year on year, while goods PCE picked up to 0.9% year on year. This was the fastest pickup in year on year change for goods since April of 2023. So the PCE index data is not the only piece of the release. The broader release, the personal income and outlays, really showed that there was continued consumer strength, with both personal income and disposable income rising 0.4% on the month through August, and personal consumption expenditures climbed a bit more robust 0.6% through August. However, real disposable income barely rose 0.1%. And this really underscored that inflation is eroding consumers' purchasing power. And you see that erosion also coming through in the savings rate, which was still pretty low, but not crossing a critical threshold at 4.6% in August. But that's down from 4.8% a month ago and well below the 5.2% a year ago. So if you take that picture together of consumers are still spending, but starting to dip a bit more into their savings, I think that this is showing that the aggressive spending relative to disposable income that many households are really still doing is starting to stretch them a bit further. If you try to take this report and put it into the context of commercial real estate, I think that this is two edges here, right? Two sides to this coin. The first is that the consumer is still super strong. I think that's a positive for some of those more consumer-facing sectors, such as retail, hospitality, or any sort of experiential property because ultimately, if the consumer's still there, there's still demand for that space. However, the fact that consumers are starting to dip, are starting to stretch, and they're funding a bit more of their spending with what would have been savings, you know, kind of medium term and longer term, we're getting into that kind of unsustainable spending space. But a final kind of comment I would have on personal income and outlays is that while the consumer picture is still generally healthy and consumption is quite robust as it's been for years now, that if you look at the kind of distribution of wealth and distribution of spending, you're seeing way more concentration in a much smaller proportion of the overall population. And so while this aggregate data does capture the aggregate picture, we have the wealth in the U.S. is highly fragmented, where the top 1% of households control about 31% of all wealth, which if that were to translate into consumption as well, and you were to assume that they are spending proportionally to the share of wealth, this aggregated consumer picture gets a little bit rockier. And so this is something that I think is, even though the data is there to show this kind of persistent, strong consumer story, I think we ultimately dig a little bit deeper and recognize that there are going to be a number of cases, or there is support for making the point that the consumer's not necessarily entirely better off. But Cole, I got a little soft there, but in terms of transitioning to other soft consumer data, why don't you tell us what you're seeing with consumer sentiment?
Yeah, well, I think what you just said is actually probably the key to understanding why this sentiment data continues to look so sour while the aggregate spending data looks so good. It's possible that they're surveying a much wider swath of consumers, and this is why you wouldn't see that actually show up in that aggregate spending data. This actually came out the exact same day, so I think it's appropriate to pair them together, even though they're about a different month. But this was the final readout for September of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index. It came in at 55.1. That was down from 58.2 in August, so about a 5.3% monthly drop. But a pretty big annual drop of 21.6%. It's split into two economic gauges. You have the current economic conditions index, which fell to 60.4 versus 61.7 from the month prior. And the forward-looking expectations index, this is where you saw a big drop to 51.7 from 55.9. A couple of things worth mentioning about this. We are still seeing levels of this index that are at or even below the worst parts of the global financial crisis. Either there's something particular going on in the economy that's making people feel much worse than they would have even at that point, or something has happened with the survey data. But I think it's worth mentioning that despite all this, this is a really difficult readout. And I think a lot of it is still coming through with the inflation expectations. If you take a look at that portion of the survey, which is not exclusively or explicitly included within the sentiment index, but is surveyed, inflation expectations for the year ahead were down, but to 4.7%. That's huge. And long run expectations of 3.7%. I think that's over the next 5 years. Consumers in the survey did voice heightened concerns over inflation, weakening labor markets, deteriorating business conditions, and a lot were saying this was explicitly related to tariffs, so eroding personal finances, among other things. But again, like we said, personal income and outlays reports showed real spending growing a bit in August, but I think we might have understood some of the difference there. But assuming there is a decent amount of discretionary spending still occurring, I think the implication for our particular industry is that there might be some near-term support for commercial real estate that is tied to discretionary spending. But as the expectations continue to drop, you may see some of that resilience fade as people pull back. So I think a couple of mixed signals here about the consumer, but worth getting another couple months of this data to understand what's really going on. And maybe it'll take us digging a little bit further into some of this data as it's split by income insofar as we can actually get it. But now, I know that there was another big release last week. Do you want to tell us about GDP?
Of course. It's the BEA on the 25th, they released the third and final estimate of Q2 GDP and real GDP. And it showed that real GDP grew at a pace of 3.8%. That's an annualized quarterly pace. And that's up from the prior estimate of 3.3%. The upward revision of about half a percentage point was driven really largely by revised estimates for consumer spending, particularly in transportation, financial services, and insurance, and a sharper drop in imports, which ultimately increase GDP. But real final sales to private domestic purchasers is a gauge that more and more market participants seem to be paying attention to. And the reason is that strips out any sort of trade or inventory swings. That was also revised up to 2.9%, which was a full percentage point revision upwards from the prior estimate. And so that confirms and really shows this resilient domestic demand still being there. Also in the GDP release was corporate profits data, which rose just $6.8 billion. That was a downward revision from the second estimate of $58.7 billion and ultimately was well below the kind of market expectations coming into the third and final release. And if you look at the corporate profits data, what that signals, pairing it with the inflation data, is that there's ultimately ongoing margin pressures in the aggregate corporate picture within the U.S. I think this is pretty explainable, or at least there's an obvious narrative around that, which would be broadly cooling economy with pockets of, I would say, concern, but still elevated cost pressures pretty much throughout the supply chain and throughout business models in terms of the cost of financing and pretty much all your input costs have risen and continue to rise. But one thing that I would also flag with this aggregated corporate profit data is that similarly to that consumer picture, the aggregate does tell a story. But that being said, there's a lot of sector differences amongst the corporates. And this is something that I'm calling out now because it's not a forecast or a call in that way. But as we close out Q3 and we head into earnings season, I think that there's going to be a lot more clarity and color that will come out on these earnings calls across the sectors around which industries, which sectors are really facing this margin compression. But the final note on GDP is that the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model, which is now casting using the latest inputs that are being released across the economy, does show that a Q3 real GDP estimate, at least as of recording on the 30th, is 3.9% for the third quarter, which is another stellar and very robust estimate. But GDP, consumer prices, that's not everything. Another big category that everybody is tuned in on is labor. We got a big release with the JOLTS. Colt, what were some of the takeaways there?
Labor sounds like about the only thing we haven't covered today, so we'll jump into it. We're recording on the 30th, so it came out this morning, had a little bit of time to dig into it. But this is a product of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. It showed that job openings rose slightly in August to 7.23 million. That was up from 7.21 in July. Hiring declined by a decent amount, though, by 114,000 to 5.13 million. Quits were down. Layoffs were down as well. So this is peculiar, but it does underscore that employers are reluctant to cut staff despite softer overall demand for labor. So the ratio of job openings to unemployed workers, which I know I mentioned on one of our previous podcasts, is now just right at 1-to-1 or slightly below. So This is still close to the lowest level since 2021. At one point in that window post-COVID, there were about 2 job openings for every unemployed worker, and it's effectively been collapsing ever since. So I think there are a couple of implications here. The labor market appears to be loosening, but not necessarily collapsing. Just broadly, job openings remain elevated relative to where we were in 2019. But the decline in hires and quits is really interesting here. I think diminished confidence among both employers and workers is causing fewer people to move around, fewer people to post jobs, to hire. There might be some easing on wage pressures on the demand side of things, really weaken long-term growth in some sectors, but ultimately, I do think this does strengthen the case for further monetary easing. Federal Reserve may view the softening as evidence that inflation is not as huge of a risk. Just looking specifically at CRE, though, softer hiring backdrop, softer demand for growth in office space, retail, industrial, where expansion plans are really a big driver and they hinge on workforce growth. But slower wage gains could be helpful for operators in controlling expenses, but on the flip side, could restrain consumer spending, could really weigh on retail and hospitality. So I think the thing that gives me a little hope here is that the level of layoffs is still below where it was even before the pandemic. Definitely could provide somewhat of a buffer here in the labor market that we're not seeing a lot of people get let go. So pretty cautious outlook. I'd say if you're an investor or lender, you're still probably focused on those defensive property types that aren't tied to discretionary spending. But I think we will get a much better picture of the labor market with the hopeful Friday release of the employment report, if we have one, though this will be one that we will not get in the event of a government shutdown. But a lot of different econ data today. So, Omar, we usually spend a lot of time talking to each other about what's going on in the economy and CRE, but we're doing something a little different today. How about you introduce our guest?
Certainly. So we wanted to bring on other voices from Altus. And the first guest that we thought of, because we spend a lot of time with him in the office and we hear his views all the time and wanted to share that with the audience, is Dan Kudrick. He's a senior director and a leader within our valuation advisory practice at Altus. And Dan will share some of his views and some of the key topics that he's hearing from clients, other valuers, and really what he's thinking about as most relevant for CRE as we enter the fourth quarter of 2025. Dan, it's great to have you on. So welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast. And we brought you here really to discuss and hear what's on the top of your mind. What are some of the themes and trends that you're paying attention to?
Yeah, thank you, Omar. I probably have bugged both of you enough on internal research calls where either I'm chiming in during or after, and or maybe it's all of our water cooler chats that maybe run a little long, where I finally got to the point where I don't know if it was you cajoling me to get on here or me cajoling you all to join. So I'm really thankful for the opportunity to speak with you today. So yeah, what's on my mind these days? Human capital. We're in a time right now where we're seeing a lot of change, as everybody can see that. And the idea is, what are we doing with our people? How are we looking at things? You know, I'm fresh off a conference, just getting back from the Counselors of Real Estate. They had a seminar. And, you know, really, when you look at getting together with people and how we value our people, for the longest time, it was really valuing individuals who would have a black book of contacts. They would build up over the years a series of relationships, getting to know people. The other way folks were valued were their ability to retain information and to learn about different markets, research markets. But the world's changed in a big way. A lot of these things are more readily available than ever before. Talking to some of the younger members of an organization like that one, they're having a harder time with some of the value proposition on things like conventions when they feel like they can get a lot of information quickly that they get through avenues like this, like podcasts or series of Zoom calls. But what's maybe lost in that is just how do we build individuals? And that organization, more than others, and maybe it'll be a shameless plug, these are seasoned industry professionals, not only in very different avenues of commercial real estate. There are architects, there are attorneys there, there are a lot of advisors and valuation professionals. And the opportunity to test ideas and to have that kind of a forum where maybe it's not as transactional, maybe it's not about pulling aside and, you know, handing out a card and winning a business deal right away. Maybe it's more about growing that human side that I think is still going to be very important going forward.
Do you think that this is more pronounced in any specific area of real estate?
I don't know. I think it's probably coming from a lot of segments, right? I think you could really draw those parallels in so many of the different professions. And maybe we're way out in the real, like, beginning tip of the iceberg of this. The way I think about it is, okay, if some of this knowledge is going to be, for lack of a better term, democratized, or it's there for everyone to kind of have that same first base level, what do we do beyond that? And how do we differentiate? And how do we grow new professionals? I was thinking about it a little bit like this idea of like black swan humans. Like if we end up building algorithms or having this base of regular knowledge, then how do people know when it's wrong? How do they know when it's time to shift? You know, having individuals who have the ability to dissect this and know when it's time to have a different idea and a different, and that could be it right down to investment. And, you know, the other area of professionals were investors, the developers, you know, also thinking about those next level ideas. I think it's something that if we're not finding ways to cultivate that talent, I think we could run into some real issues down the road, but, you know, probably way too early on that yet.
So, Dan, I know you hire a lot of young valuers, and there's a lot of concern that folks coming out of college now, particularly trying to get into our field, they think that AI is going to replace a lot of those entry-level analysts. There's concern that even getting your foot in the door to even have the 10 years to get experience to become, say, a counselor of real estate might be tough. Do you hear anything at the conference, or you have any thoughts on that?
Well, probably more thoughts-wise, I think that's been in the backdrop there. It's interesting, right? I reflect on my own kind of experiences and career of how I got here. I remember being a young man in school before even university where, hey, I wanted to be a businessman. I wanted to travel, see the world, see cities, come from a blue-collar background in New Jersey where, you know, folks at the time there were still factory jobs out there and people were working in different ways. And one of the appeals of real estate was the idea that it was tangible. You could go to it. You could see it. This last generation, we got away from that in large swaths. Everything became statistical. Everything became rote, where you just did this work and you really didn't analyze the way the cities were built, the way they interact, the way properties work and are situated. And I think getting back to a little bit of that, getting the opportunity for people to learn this business and do that boots on the ground could be an interesting way that over time, do we need to do some of that? So don't really have those answers yet, but I do think we need to be careful about that. This idea of who's going to truly be able to interpret the trends and be able to speak to where those next great investment ideas are, just being able to truly articulate where we are in a given market is important.
So a lot is changing in the broader economy, how we work, how we live, how we play, using the, I think it was CBRE's framework. But in the world of valuation, I know some of those big structural shifts are challenging certain valuation concepts, including residual value. And that's something that I know we've talked about for probably a couple hours in different kind of fragmented conversations. But what are some of your thoughts, concerns, and views on the topic of residual values?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That was certainly one of those next things on my mind and thinking about. And going back to how we analyze property, we're, for the most part, building cash flows. We're doing projection periods, many times 10-year projections. And very routinely, those residual values or that expected selling exit price is upwards of 60% higher, 40% at least. And with that goes a lot of projections. So part of this is the actual nuts and bolts of saying, hey, how often do we really look at that back end? Granted, these are projections, but how do those different projections differ? And maybe over time, doing more on understanding where some of those stack up would be interesting. But I'm really getting at a deeper topic of the idea of how are these properties situated economically, of course, but also physical and sustainable? And how are these properties going to connect in a new world? If we're moving away from some of the old mobility patterns and we get to self-driving vehicles, or we really change some of how we're set up, have we really thought about that? One of the interesting things here, just got back from Detroit, and this is a city that rarely is on people's top 20 lists. And, you know, as someone from New Jersey, maybe I can sympathize or understand the idea of being discounted at times where there is probably more than meets the eye. And, you know, what was interesting there is that city's on the uptrend. There is a bit of a renaissance there. And some of these older buildings just refuse to go away. And maybe some of that was for a lack of being able to knock them down and demolish them. These properties in the downtown core were built in the 1920s and 30s, and they were built substantially to the point now as they get rehabilitated and as the city explores new areas of growth, these are buildings that are actually back. And they've stood the test of time. And maybe some of the product that was built over the more recent past, we should be taking a look at how sustainable are they? How will they fit with the new environment? Just there's a lot there. And maybe tip of the iceberg, as we get really good with the number side of this valuation profession, is it time for us to go back and understand the patterns of how and where things are built and understanding those portions of what are really large aspects of value.
When I think of residual values and from a sector, a real estate sector lens, two sectors immediately pop up and they're on the area of concern. One is office, which we've seen a massive shift in terms of valuations, but that's largely driven by the demand function and the U.S. kind of being oversupplied. But then also data centers, right, where it's a rapidly growing demand, but there's a lot of uncertainty, I would say, in terms of how quickly these properties can be obsolete given the change of pace of the demand and the kind of innovation that accompanies it. Do you have any thoughts on either of those sectors and residual values?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And how many hours do we have here, right? And maybe those are two very different. But first, on the office side, I think the death of office in CBDs is probably greatly exaggerated, right? There is a real feel that, and look, this is not for the entire property stock, but in our major markets, or really in most of our markets, to get to this idea of you still need synergy and having these great bastions of a place to work and where there is some ability to cross collaborate, whether it's within your own company or industry or just being out in the world and having your lunch and seeing something and understanding that, to understand some of these trends we're talking about, there is a feel that the better amenitized buildings or the better located buildings are going to have value. Now, there's also large swaths of that stock where if they're in locations that are not going to be resilient, if they're not going to be connected in the right way, if they're isolated, yeah, I think maybe, you know, a harder look at what that exit value looks like still needs to happen in many ways. And I've seen it on a few investments where folks have gotten in on good deals where they have underwritten a very pessimistic or not expecting a lot on the back end, basically underwriting the deal for the remainder of it, of its current leasing life and going from there. So probably a lot there. I think on data centers, look, a lot of this could be the technology, and that's probably not an area of, well, it's definitely not an area of strength in our industry, and we're rapidly learning, and there is no doubt right now that demand outlook looks pretty fascinating. I mean, this is going to be a large property sector for sure. And I think you're alluding to this idea of what does residual value look like? What if the technology changes? What if the needs for those buildings become more obsolete and on the back end? What does that mean? Fortunately, I don't think a lot of these investments right now are anticipating or expecting huge returns on the back end of the equation, which is helpful. I think a lot of this is front loaded and it's the income generation over the immediate life of that asset hold, rather than expecting to do this for a hope note and hoping to turn these or flip these 10, 20 years from now. So we'll see. But that is certainly what's on the mind for sure.
And another key theme that you raised was around overall transparency. Can you dive into that?
Yeah. What do I mean by that? Yeah. You know, the amount of times I've been asked by management, portfolio managers, asset managers, wondering how or whether their assets are appropriately valued and comparatively, and how are they being treated comparatively to other similar funds. And that's something where we have the tools to do this. We are doing this. Having to explain those nuances of where an asset is located compared to some of their peers, how it's being valued, that's still an area where I think this industry has a lot of catching up to do. I wonder why they continue to have this feel, or why investors put up with this idea that, hey, you know, are these funds, you know, are these properties viewed differently? And maybe that gets back to where we started with all this, which is there's still an element of an appraisal report being an opinion of value by an individual valuer. Obviously, technology is moving so quickly, so rapidly. There's a consensus in some ways on where it's certainly on how to do the appraisal, and maybe a confluence of all that data of what is moving that individual market has gotten so more precise. That's one area where, you know, automation and machine learning is going to allow for a more level playing field here. That should be embraced by the industry. Transparency leads to letting these investment professionals go out and make their mark on their ideas of how and where they're investing, and not expecting any kind of overhang of just maybe mispricing. Like, that shouldn't come into the equation ever. You know, it should be performance really ruling the day. So we're getting there on transparency, certainly. And I think that's what's moving so, so rapidly. But that's certainly what's on top of mind for sure.
If you were to fast forward, say, 10 years from now, what do you think one of the biggest changes to either CRE valuation or to just the CRE industry will be?
I mean, I certainly hope we one day get to the spot where we have our app and in our industry to have funds where someone quickly see how those properties are performing, or having almost a daily mark, right? That's where we're going with fund flows, and investor have this requirement for liquidity and individuals want to get in. Understanding this is a long-term hold. This is a long-term investment class, that there was less necessity to get there as quick. But the idea to allow everyone to compete, where they're competing for investment ideas for the properties they hold, and to do so in a way where they can have the comfort, investors can have the comfort of knowing exactly what's moving the needle in many ways. So I know it's kind of, this conversation's been very like two-sided, where the one side is the immediacy and the accuracy of being able to do things. And the other side is almost that idea of getting back to what real property is and looking at real property for how it's connected to the greater world, how it's physically situated, that being a requirement that's very necessary.
Yeah, Dan, I was just thinking about it too. On the one hand, you've got this idea, you know, with greater transparency, you're probably going to encourage more people to invest in real assets. But at the same time, these are real tangible things that one tenant leaves, your value is gone, right? So this is, it's complicated stuff, but I can see how there's a kind of a lever effect with this. But so Dan, really appreciate you joining us on the show, and we'll look forward to having you back sometime.
Yeah, we would love to do so. Thanks, gentlemen.
Well, we want to thank Dan for joining us. Again, we like to have other voices from Altus come on. A lot of super sharp folks working directly with clients that we like to hear from. So we want to thank him again and hopefully have him back on sometime. But Omar, we've got a lot coming up. How about you share with our listeners some of the upcoming data releases?
Absolutely. We've packed agenda in terms of upcoming data releases with the massive caveat of assuming that there is no government shutdown. We have recorded this on the 30th of September. And so if there is no government shutdown, we can expect to see the employment report, S&P's final PMI, and the ISM services index on Friday, October 3rd. Then on Tuesday, the 7th, we'll be looking at the U.S. trade deficit as well as consumer credit. And on the 8th, minutes from September's FOMC meeting. On the 9th or Thursday, we get wholesale inventories, and closing out next week on Friday the 10th, the preliminary consumer sentiment data for October.
Excellent. Omar, I think that's all the time we've got today. But before we sign off, I do want to encourage our listeners that if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Please give us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We will read them. Or feel free to just send us an email, altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of the CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.